Welcome back, everybody. How you doing? Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the Allstate studio on the 7th floor of the Trib Tower. And we're here till 5 a.m. It's Monday. And as you can tell, that means we're going to do the Monday morning movie reviews. Not that much to talk about this week. It's a pretty quick one. And then we'll also discuss box office as well. Interesting stuff happening on the box office front, that's for sure. And then, of course, it's Monday, which means my dad is going to call in and tell a joke because it's a jokey time. And we're going to talk about teen idols and celebrity crushes and all that cool stuff. That's all coming up a little bit later on the show. 312-981-7200 is the phone number for talk and text. 312-981-7200. You can also check us out on Twitter. Best way to stay connected, though, is on our Facebook page, facebook.com/NickDShow. You can like us right now, facebook.com/NickDShow. Every Monday morning, Colin Suter and Eric Childress join me, as they have for many years, reviewing all the new movies. Eric Childress and Colin Suter, you can see them at efilmcritic.com, also rogerebert.com, and much more. And we'll discuss the new movies and box office as well. Here's Eric. Hello, Eric.
Hello.
And Colin. Hello, Colin.
Hello.
Hello. All right. Before we get to the movies, which there aren't many to talk about, I understand, Eric, that when I get home in the morning and watch Twin Peaks, I'm in for something.
Yeah. And as you're one of the people that are clearly very much on board.
Oh yeah.
With this thing, you are going to lose your mind.
Well, here's the thing. I didn't think it would get weirder than episode 3, but my news feed blew up around 9 p.m. last night.
Yeah.
Like people I was like, well, all right, I'm going to have to like prepare myself for this, I guess.
Yeah, you know, like all those memes and tweets that you see where, you know, so like, well, nothing could get worse than this, and then they go, "Well, hold my beer."
Yeah.
This is like hold my keg.
I can't wait.
No, and you enjoy it, my friend.
Oh, man.
That's all I'll say. I'm watching Twin Peaks because, frankly, there's nothing else on at this point.
Yeah, okay. Colin, are you watching it?
No. Okay. I've never been...
that's right.
Yeah, I've never really been on board with Twin Peaks, but that's because I've never really seen it, so...
Yeah.
On my to-do list.
Well, I mean, listen, you know, this version of Twin Peaks is just... It's insane. I mean, what was on ABC 25 years ago, you know, that's completely normal and accessible compared to what's happening now on the show.
That's what I'm gathering every week on my Facebook feed. I just see more posts every time an episode airs of, well, I don't know what the heck is going on, but okay.
Yeah. As I posted last week during an entire sequence while someone was mopping or cleaning up a floor,
yeah.
I just simply put film it all, Ed.
I posted that too, Eric. I was like, only David Lynch would use 3.5 minutes of footage of a guy sweeping a floor.
Yeah. And I'm telling you, I'm not joking when I say this, and you know, some people will rail me for it, the diehards, but you could put the Twin Peaks episode tonight on like double speed and watch it. And I don't think you'd lose anything, frankly.
Okay. All right. I just I'm so excited about it.
Yeah.
So that's TV, though. And again, real quickly, speaking of TV, Eric, I know that you binged Glow this
week. I did.
I did, too. I thought it was great.
I did, too.
Yeah.
It was so much fun. Bree and Marin are really good.
Really good.
Really good on the show.
Yeah.
Gilpin is really good. I mean, and it's just a great ensemble. There's not really like a weak link in the entire cast.
Yeah.
And it's nostalgic, yet timely. It's, you know, it's funny, yet it has some really sweet moments in it. You know, and I like the fact that it's all, you know, I was expecting it. Them to like get to the show like very early, and then it's going to be progress the report of the show. They don't get to the show really until the final episode,
yeah,
which is great.
yeah it's all build up. But I thought it was great. I used to watch Glow in the 80s when it was on, and I thought this was a real nice, you know, piece of nostalgia. I also love the fact, and you must have loved this, Eric, that the references
first
to
5 minutes of the show.
Well, yeah, let's not even, that was like, that was a nice treat.
Uh-huh.
I was like, whoa! I didn't expect it.
Thank you.
I didn't expect that.
No.
But I was happy about it.
Mm-hmm.
No, I was saying the hilarious references to Back to the Future.
Oh, my God.
Oh.
That joke. I mean, I don't even want to spoil
right,
it. But
right.
I was told that it was coming, and I was worried that I had missed it, but it happens very late in the show.
It does, yeah.
And when And as soon as Maron says, you know, his pitch for the movie,
right,
it was like, oh, here it comes.
Yeah, it was great. And then there's also, you know, like you mentioned some of it, the relationship that eventually evolves between Maron and Bree.
Mm-hmm.
Is really lovely. He goes with her to this place. I'm not going to give away what it is, but that is a wonderful sequence.
It really is.
And really, you know, like not a lot of talking in it. It's just a really, you know,
mm-hmm.
it was really sweet and really good. I really like it a lot. And I watched it all over the weekend. So I just wish.
I've been recommending it to friends all weekend as soon as I started watching it.
Yeah.
Like, this is great. You have to check it out.
Colin, have you watched any of it or not?
Not yet, no.
Yeah, it's really good, man. It is. It's terrific. And you don't have to have watched Glow in order to enjoy it. You really don't. I mean, but it helps because there's some wonderful sort of asides that take place during it. And there's, of course, fantastic costumes and hair.
Mm-hmm.
And the soundtrack rules. So it's,
yes.
So anyway, Glow on Netflix is awesome. And I will let you know about Twin Peaks tomorrow.
Yeah, enjoy.
Yeah. All right. So I'm the only one who saw Maudie.
Yeah.
So I'll take care of that one. It's based on a true story about a woman named Maude Lewis who was stricken with rheumatoid arthritis at a very young age. And it caused her paralysis and her hands to be misshapen, and she's hunched over, and she suffered from this for a long time. She lives with a horrible aunt and a terrible brother who find a way to cut her out of the inheritance. And she lives in Nova Scotia, and she wants to get out on her own, and that's basically what the movie is about. It's played by Sally Hawkins, by the way. The great Sally Hawkins. And so she sees a posting for a housekeeper for a fishmonger, a local fishmonger who lives like in a one-room, sort of two-room shack. And he's played by Ethan Hawke. And so she decides that she wants to take this job as a housekeeper, even though she really is not sure how to clean or cook, especially with the arthritis that she has. They start out having kind of a little gruffy relationship. He barely even speaks. Then they eventually fall in love, and they develop a great relationship, and they get married. And then the movie is about her discovery of her expression through painting. She begins to paint on the windows of the shack and on the walls, and it becomes sort of a local celebrity, and people start to know her through her artwork. It's not necessarily the greatest artwork in the world, but it tells a great story, and she really taps into something and finds her own. And it's about this relationship with these two people based on a true story. It's very low key. It's really sweet and very well acted. Both performances are great. Ethan Hawke is really terrific in it, but the movie belongs, as most movies that she's in, Sally Hawkins. She owns this movie. She's tremendous in it. I didn't know anything about the real woman. She became sort of a legend in that area, and a successful artist. And this is the basically the story of their relationship and her coming into her own. After having this debilitating issue and having a terrible family life, she finds someone that she can fall in love with, and that's what the movie's about, and is able to express herself. It's a sweet little movie. Sally Hawkins is great in it, and there are some really wonderful moments between her and Ethan Hawke, who has a real interesting use of his voice in this movie. It's like he gargled with sandpaper or something. It's just a very strange. But there's good chemistry between the two of them. And if you're a fan of Sally Hawkins, this is a fantastic set piece for her. She gets to do a lot of really great work, and she's always good. So I'm recommending Maudie. It's playing at the Landmark Century at Clark and Diversey. And I would go. I would definitely make a trip out there to check it out. It's really terrific. And I'm obviously a huge fan of Sally Hawkins. And you know, anytime you get to see her showcased in a movie, it's always good. And this is no exception. She's great in it. It's a really good film. So that's Maudie, and I am recommending it. All right, guys, hang on, okay?
Mm-hmm.
All right, we got to take a break, and when we come back after the news, we'll jump into some of the other new movies that came out. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. Monday morning movie reviews will continue after this break for the news on 720 WGN. Hey, welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the Allstate studio on the 7th floor of the Trib Tower. And we're here till 5 a.m. Steve Grzanich with the opening bell at 5 and the great Steve Cochran at 6 for your morning drive. It's Monday. Happy Monday, everybody. Monday means my dad calls in and tells a joke. It's jokey time, and it's brought to you by the greatest restaurant on the planet, the Gale Street Inn. We thank George and everybody at the Gale Street Inn for being great and for sponsoring my dad's joke. Monday also means movie reviews. Don't have that many this week, so we're talking about it, and we're going to do the box office as well. So let's welcome Eric Childress back. Eric, welcome back.
Thank you.
And Colin, welcome back.
Hello.
All right. Well, Colin, why don't you tell us about Painted Black?
All right. Well, this stars Aaliyah Shawkat as a woman named Josie, who she poses nude for art classes, and that's where she met her boyfriend, who early in the film commits suicide. And, you know, this is a woman who, you know, she goes to clubs at night. She doesn't have much in the way of prospects, but the suicide is devastating to her, of course. And she, you know, recounts her days with her now deceased boyfriend. And this past represents a much different part of her life than it is right now. And his only, parents, who are played by Janet McTeer and Alfred Molina, they're divorced, and the mother, she calls Josie one night and asks, soon after the suicide, and asks, you know, if she had never met her son, would he have killed himself? And McTeer keeps calling on her to learn more about her son and their relationship, but she's also tormenting Josie and trying to make their grief a shared experience while also resenting her at the same time. And this relationship between the mother and Josie becomes a little more hurtful towards one another. So this is the directorial debut of Amber Tamblyn, and she shows a real assured hand as a director. And this is a really beautiful film about grief between these two women that is kind of, it gets a little hallucinatory at times. There are little dream sequences, for lack of a better word, that takes place, which I didn't think were as strong as the narrative that was going on in you know, between Shawkat and McTeer. They didn't really add much for me. I thought that the stuff away from that was interesting enough that it didn't really need it. But it does show that Amber Tamblyn has an interesting visual flair. So it's more of an interesting showcase for Tamblyn's visual sense, more than, you know, a narrative strength. But as far as her directorial debut goes overall, it's very impressive and very interesting. And she's got a really terrific cast here. I mean, Shawkat is really just wonderful in this movie. And McTeer and is also very good. I wish there was more Alfred Molina. Would have been nice. But this is a really promising start for an actress who's, you know, always been a solid on-screen presence, and she's a pretty solid behind the camera as well. So, and this is playing at Facets right now, and is worth checking out.
Yeah. Okay. And Eric, what about you?
Yeah, I agree, and I think the thing that really stands out about the movie is the visual sense. Tamblyn has a really great eye for composition and is putting together shots that are beautiful and sometimes haunting. I didn't mind the sort of the dream hallucinatory sequences so much because they were an extension of that visual sense that I was really enjoying in the film. There's another film we're going to talk about that has a little bit of that I didn't care for, but in this one I didn't mind so much. And she also shows that she's really has a really good hand with actors as well. I mean, there are times in this movie where, you know, Colin describing the plot of it, about the sort of this push and pull between these two characters. And there are moments in the film that threaten to kind of almost take this into a real camp-like situation. There's their initial meeting at a funeral is over the top, but it could have gone even further than that. And there are moments in the film that threatened to go that so far, but Tamlin knows exactly when to pull back from it and focus on the faces of the two actors, who I both think are really good. Shaw Cat, I think, is one of her stronger film performances. McTeer is really good. Again, at times, threatens could go completely off the rails into camp, but manages to sort of find the reality of the hurt that she's going through. These are the kind of films that don't get big releases, but you get a sense that, you know, given the right material and the right budget, that a film by Amber Tamblyn would be something welcomed on in a greater sense in the indie circuit.
Yeah, I got to say, I think it's a pretty great directorial debut, and I had no idea that she was directing. Had no idea. For those of you who don't know, Amber Tamblyn, actress, probably best known for Joan of Arcadia, the TV show Joan of Arcadia. Would that be the mm-hmm. thing that she's best known for? Yeah, right.
I would think so. Yeah.
Daughter of what's his name, Ross Tamblyn.
Russ.
Who was a legendary actor. And worked with David Lynch. So anyway, this is a really interesting film, and the visual flourishes are really nice. I was just really happy to see, I don't know, man. I was just really happy to see Janet McTeer on the screen. You know what I mean? Because she's a terrific actress, and you don't get to see a lot of her. And I agree with you, Colin. There's always room for more Alfred Molina in everyone's life, as far as I'm concerned. And I'm a big fan of Aaliyah Shawkat. I think she's terrific and a very unusual actress. And I've really liked her on TV and whenever she pops up in movies and stuff. I've always found her to be really interesting, and she's a great foil to McTeer in this movie. And it's really well made. It's a little film. But I guess it's the book that it's based on is a pretty popular one, from what I understand. I have not read it, but it's another movie about grief and how to deal with grief and how it affects those around you, those that are left behind. So it's called Paint It Black, and I think that's three recommendations for that one right there. So, all right, Eric, tell everybody if you can. about The Bad Batch, if it's possible for you to. To sum it up.
Piece together what I remember seeing of this film. I saw it at the Toronto Film Festival last September, so it's been a little while, 9 some months or something like that. Mm-hmm. But it's a post-apocalyptic film. It's the new film from Anna Lily Amanpour, who last directed a movie called Girl Walks Home Alone at Night, which was very well acclaimed on the on the festival circuit, which I still actually haven't seen. So I apologize for that.
It's good.
Yeah, that's what I hear. I hear nothing but really good things about that film, which is one that kind of slipped past my radar. But this one is, again, it's kind of an apocalyptic story. Scavengers are, throughout the land, trying to make do. And we meet a woman named Arlen, played by Sookie Waterhouse, who is scavenging the land, trying to survive herself, and she is picked up, captured, more to the point, very early on in the film by a group of cannibals who lop off one of her legs for dinner, and she manages to escape and manages to get some help and get a prosthetic leg so she can continue going on. And then she comes upon a cult group that's led by Keanu Reeves' character, a town named Comfort. We've seen these kind of things in these apocalyptic stories before, and there's a lot of Mad Max influences here, particularly, involving his harem of sorts. And when she, kind of doesn't want to be a part of this society, she ends up taking some drugs and ends up kind of wandering off into the desert. And then she's found by another guy known as Miami Man, who's played by Jason Momoa. And he's rescued her, but she has what is she kill? He killed his. She killed his wife or
yeah.
something.
Yeah.
Yeah. She killed his wife very early in the film, and his daughter has gone missing.
Right.
And so she eventually is going to go off to help find his daughter and blah 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 blah. So that's what I remember about the film. And the one thing that I really remember about the film was how much I really liked the setup of the film. I mean, it's apocalyptic survival stories, tend to be very interesting when done very well, particularly when you have a lone survivor like this and the crazies that she comes upon. And when you have your heroine, you know, get a leg lopped off in the first 10 minutes of the movie, in graphic fashion too, you are thinking that you're in the hands of something.
She also loses an arm, Eric.
What's that?
She also loses an arm.
That's right. Yeah. See, I already forgot that.
Yeah.
I remember the leg so much.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. And so you lose that, and you just figure that you're in for something kind of crazy, but the movie never really lives up to that promise. Even as appealing as Keanu Reeves has been so often in these small supporting roles that he's been taken, I go back to the Neon Demon last summer, which it might be the same character. I don't even know. But, even he isn't enough to sort of draw my interest, because the movie just flat out gets really boring after a while. I mean, this is, it's only Mad Max in plot devices and things. It's certainly not an action film by any stretch of the imagination. And I don't think it finds, the kind of the really interesting things it wants to say about anything, frankly. I just remember being really bored by the movie. The longer it went on, the more bored I got. I didn't really care who found who or who survived, or who got back their daughter or who survives the cult or what's going on with the harem. I didn't care about any of it by the end of the movie. I was just glad it was over.
Mm. All right. Well, we got a break here, and then we'll come back and I'll tell you what I thought of it. Colin, you didn't see it, right?
Did not see it.
Okay. We're going to take a break here, and we'll come back and I'll tell you what I thought of The Bad Batch. And then Colin drew the short straw this week. He'll tell you all about the new Transformers movie. All right. We'll take a break, and then we'll do box office after that. So everybody hang on. We'll be right back after this on 720 WGN. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the Allstate Studio, 7th floor of the Trib Tower. How are you? It is Monday morning. That means my dad will be calling in to tell a joke, because it's a jokey, jokey, jokey time. And it's brought to you by the greatest restaurant on the planet, the Gale Street Inn, galestreet.com. And So we've got that coming up, and we're going to talk about teen idols, your first celebrity crushes, and all that fun stuff as well. 312-981-7200 is the phone number for talk and text. 312-981-7200. We are in the middle of the movie reviews, and also Eric and I will talk box office. That's coming up in a few minutes. And welcome back, Eric.
Thank you.
And welcome back, Colin. Let's see. Before the break, Eric told us about The Bad Batch, which is this new film, and saw it last year at Toronto, or just this past September at Toronto. And it's now at the Music Box, and it's also playing on video on demand. And as Eric described, it's a very strange, post-apocalyptic, weird movie. I, for the most part, agree with you, Eric. I think I liked it more than you did, because there are things in it that I love. There are certain sequences that I think are really great. I think this woman's a very interesting filmmaker. Her first movie is better than this one, I can tell you. But there are things in this movie that I think are great, and especially in terms of performance. Like, I really think Suki Waterhouse is terrific in this movie. I think it's a really weird and sort of stunning and really cool performance. And in fact, I think everybody is good in this movie. I think Keanu Reeves is awesome and hilarious in it. Diego Luna plays like a DJ he plays a DJ in the world of comfort. And there's, some of the elements don't all work, and it really never comes together. It just seems to be a style in search of substance. And yeah, she, clearly has seen the Mad Max movies, as everybody has.
and is, you know, taken from there and taken from all of, you know, many other post-apocalyptic movies. Giovanna Ribisi is really good in this movie and very strange. He's got some wonder, because so the performances are really sort of weird and fun to watch. Jason Momoa is, I think, very interesting in the movie as well, and I've never found that guy even remotely interesting on any level. And I really thought he did some strange, wonderful work here. Jim Carrey's in it, who he plays like a hermit. He's barely recognizable in it. He does some really weird stuff that's fun to watch. So elements of the movie, I think, are great. There are sequences that I like, and I agree with you, Eric. The setup's the best part. The first half hour of the movie, first 40 minutes of the movie is the best stuff in the movie. And then it periodically is interesting and just, you know, some of it feels forced, like, oh, it's got to be weird. Let's do this. And it never really is, you know, it never really comes together. You know, at the end, I like you, Eric, I wasn't really, you know, I didn't really care. The outcome of what happened. I didn't dislike watching it because I think there's a lot of interesting visual stuff going on. And like I said, some really creative and terrific performances. So I watched it on demand. I watched it on video on demand. I didn't see it on the big screen. I think it may have been better to see on the big screen because the visuals were kind of nice and the locations are interesting. So I don't know if that had an effect on it one way or the other. But overall, like, you know, I'm not necessarily recommending it, but if you want to see some weird performances and some interesting ideas that don't necessarily come together, you could do a lot worse than this. So I'm wishy-washy on this one. If you want to see it. If you don't. That's the Bad Batch. Okay, so there it is. All right, Colin.
Yep.
Yeah, man. Is this the final one, too?
God, I hope so.
I think it is the final adventure of Transformers. Right. Transformers: The Last Night, fifth Transformer movie. All right, Colin, thank you, first of all.
Sure, don't you forget it. We won't. So here we go again. This time, humans and Transformers are at war, and it's all over the world. Optimus Prime is gone. For those of you who are keeping score, the one way to save the planet has to do with the fact that these robots existed on planet Earth long ago and has been kept secret by such luminaries as Mozart and FDR. And apparently these robots were involved in the death of Hitler as well. That's a backstory there. And this is all seen in the film's prologue, which involves King Arthur and Merlin, who is a drunken fool because Michael Bay. Anyway, this artifact was buried during this time, and long story short, it's going to take a few unlikely people to discover it and use it to destroy the bad robots and stop the evil Quintessa, which is a CGI villain who's not a robot, who's, you know, she's the evil Quintessa. That's all you need to know. Mark Wahlberg plays the working class hero who is harboring a few robots in his junkyard. Anthony Hopkins plays a professor who knows a lot about this stuff. John Turturro plays a guy who's on the phone a lot. Tony Hale plays an engineer. And Laura Haddock, she plays the girl part. Yeah, so what are we doing here?
Hang on a second, Colin. We're going to break here, okay?
Oh, man. Okay.
And then you can tell us all about it. Hold on a second. All right. There's Eric and Colin. Colin drew the short straw and ended up seeing the final Transformers movie, and I know that we're all waiting to hear Colin's explanation and his feelings about it. We're going to take a quick break for the news, and when we come back after the news, Colin will let us know what he thinks of the new Transformers movie right here on WGN. We'll be right back. Okay, welcome back, everybody. How are you? Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, Monday morning. Monday morning movie reviews continuing, and we'll talk about box office as well. My dad will call in and tell a joke because it's Monday and it's a jokey time. It's brought to you by the Gale Street Inn. And we're going to talk about your first crushes, celebrity crushes and teen idols from the past and future and present and all that stuff. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. We are here till 5 a.m. Steve Grzanich with the opening bell at 5 and the great Steve Cochran at 6 with your morning drive. Check us out on Twitter at Nick D Show, Facebook.com/Nick D Show. Best way to stay connected, so like us there. And welcome back, Eric.
Hello.
And welcome back, Colin.
Hello.
All right, Colin, you told us about the fantastic plot of Transformers: The Last Night, before the break. Now tell us about the movie. What you think?
Yeah, I told you about the plot, which I pieced together from other people's reviews because I don't remember the plot. And because what is there to remember? This is the fifth time we're doing this. It's the fifth time of just straight up noise from Michael Bay, who is taking a franchise, a concept that has a lot of potential to be entertaining and quirky and fun and cool, and is turning it into just this stupid, worthless festival of noise and really archaic humor that falls flat because, you know, this is a Michael Bay movie. Michael Bay can't do comedy, and then he should just stop. You know, these robot characters are so unengaging. And just even the way that they're rendered, you know, there's no facial expression. There's nothing in the soul of these characters that would want to, that would make us care about them. There's just nothing there for two and a half hours. There is of nothing. The human characters are just, they're not even characters. They're just props to advance the stupid storyline that I just gave. And it's just, by now you already know whether or not you want to see this film. This is the fifth one. So the audience that's going to go see it, they've already made up their minds, I guess. I will say this, and as far as that audience goes, I teach a Star Wars-based filmmaking class to kids over the summer, and I took a survey this week and asked them, okay, how many of you are interested in Transformers movies? Just curious. And 80% of these kids, and it's not a huge sample, but they're between the ages of 8 and 11. They're mostly boys, about 30 kids. And most of them, about 80% of them, said either they don't care or they've never seen it or they think they're terrible. So, I mean, that's the sort of target audience right there. And I know these movies are making money, but I don't know by who. Why are you going to see a fifth Transformers movie? I got to know what they get out of it, because the action is just labored and boring. I don't know the appeal of the Optimus Prime. I really don't. It was like one of the least memorable characters of a franchise I've ever come across. But I'm supposed to care that Optimus Prime is gone, and I'm supposed to cheer when Optimus Prime comes back. And I don't know who this character is or why I should care. And I say that about every single character in this film and all these films. They are terrible. They are the worst. And I can't imagine having to sit through another one. And it even pains me still that Steven Spielberg has his name on these movies. So he actually has to invest in them. And I can't imagine how soul-crushing that is. So here we go again. It's Transformers 5. It's more of the same. You already know whether or not you want to go see it. You should just keep avoiding it if you're avoiding them. And you should just avoid this one anyway, no matter what.
Mm. Anthony Hopkins do anything in the movie?
Yeah, he embarrasses himself, just like everybody else here. Mark Wahlberg is talking to animals. Only he's talking to robots, but it's the same basic effect as Andy Samberg had on Saturday Night Live.
Does he say, hey, Optimus, say hi to your mother for me?
Pretty much. In so many words, yeah. I mean, and he's not doing a very convincing job as an actor having to interact with, what is essentially a green screen effect or somebody wearing a tennis ball suit or whatever he's acting up against. He's doing a really bad job of convincing me that these robots are really there.
Yeah.
It just gets to be this weird sort of performance art from Mark Wahlberg. and they're just going to stick whatever in front of him. And nobody's making it at all convincing. So, yeah.
All right. Well, there you go. Transformers The Last Night. Colin didn't like it.
So. Yeah.
Okay. Jeez. All right, well, next week now we'll have some fun next week. Because next week we got Baby Driver, we got The Beguiled, we got The Big Sick, Despicable Me 3, and The House are all the big ones that are that are coming out. Is that right? That covers everything, right?
That just about covers everything. And forewarning, the house is not being screened.
Yeah, well, you know, have you seen the Red Band trailer?
Yes.
That's just their big payoff scene is a guy getting his finger chopped off and then blood,
yeah.
And then blood shooting all over the place.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I can't think that there's ever been a Will Ferrell movie that's not been screened for press.
Yeah, I don't recall.
Yeah.
any of them. I don't know, man. But it's, the guy who was, I always forget the guy's name, the actor who actually convinces them to get the casino. He's the one in the room with them when they chop the guy's finger off.
Jason Mantzoukas.
Yeah.
Is that how you pronounce his name? Yeah.
That guy's funny. And mm-hmm. I will say this, when he's gagging at the end on the trailer, when he's trying, that was funny.
Mm-hmm.
I have to admit that I laughed at that.
Yeah.
But when I see from the writers of Neighbors, I immediately go, oh, boy.
Well, that would be a plus to me because
okay.
I like the Neighbors and I like anything Vegas-themed. So this movie should be in my wheelhouse, but, you know, not screening for press. A comedy, I mean, they screened Rough Night, for God's sake.
Yeah. And they is this the first time that Will Ferrell and Amy Poehler have done a movie together?
Oh.
I mean, obviously they work together on SNL, but
well, Amy Poehler shows up in Anchorman 2, doesn't she?
Yeah, but like a major role, you know what I mean?
Yeah,
like
her like a major role.
Yeah, like you know.
Yeah, I can't think of one.
Yeah, that should be a big draw too.
Mm-hmm.
You know. All right. Well, we've got Baby Driver, we got The Big Owl, we got The Big Sick, Despicable Me 3, all coming out. So we'll have a lot to talk about next week, and then that next Thursday morning, you guys are going to come in, and we're going to do our 6 month half year. Best of lists.
Yeah.
Yeah, we'll do that. So that'll be fun. We're going to do that on my birthday, so we'll have some fun doing that. All right, cool. Colin, thanks, man, and I really appreciate you going to see the damn Transform. Did you see it in the 3Ds?
Yeah. And once in a while, I just take the glasses off and see if there's any difference, and not really.
Nick Wheel, Colin won on this one.
Yeah, we're going to have to.
The blurry picture was actually fine.
Yeah. Okay. All right, Colin. Thanks, buddy. We'll talk to you next week.
No problem.
All right, there you go. There's Colin. He took the bullet and saw Transformers. Eric, hang on, okay?
Sure thing.
We'll take a break. When we come back, Eric and I will discuss the box office for this week, and that's all coming up. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. Didn't have a lot of new movies to talk about, and Colin was kind enough to see the terrible Transformers movie for all of us. And now we're going to talk about the box office. Eric Childress writes about the box office with a box office analysis at movies.com. You can read it there, and you can also see him on the TV. Tell everybody, Eric, how they can see you on the TV.
Yeah, every Thursday morning on a show called Business First AM, I do a segment called Movies and Money where we talk about the new movies and what their impact on the box office could be.
Okay.
That's on WYCC television. If you can't find it, just DVR it. You'll find it.
There you go. That's every Thursday morning. All right, so the box office for this week, Transformers The Last Knight, $45 million, but total of $69 million because it opened on Wednesday, right?
Yeah, and that seemed to be a pretty good strategic move for Paramount to get, you know, people talking about that 69 number rather than that 45 number.
Mm-hmm.
Granted, it would have been skewed a little bit differently if it had opened on Friday, but I mean, $69 million in 5 days for a Transformers movie. I think all of the other films had made that much either in like its first or second day. So that's quite a step down from the movies of the past, but at the same time, Paramount, which is in kind of crisis mode at the moment because they've just been having bomb after bomb, and Baywatch failed this summer, and they got Ghost in the Shell from earlier this year, which is like one of the biggest bombs ever at this point.
Yeah.
And Transformers is all they have the rest of the summer. They don't have a movie opening until October. I think.
Wow.
So if Transformers somehow doesn't get a little bit of money back for them, they're going to be sitting on this for like 4 months. Now, the movies are like made like another almost $200 million overseas already, most of it in China.
Mm-hmm.
So it's over 260 some million worldwide right now, but you're not going to be even thinking about talking about profit until this hits 650. Which seems very likely, but again, that's a very conservative estimate because from what I can see, that this is actually, and I don't think it's really been reported, that it's the most expensive
production costs in the history of Paramount Pictures.
Oh, are you kidding?
No, I've looked through the entire Paramount lineup going back over two decades now. And, you know, two decades ago, there were no such thing as $200 million movies.
Right.
And they've only got a couple on the books. And with the exception of Iron Man 2, they're all Transformers movies. This one came in at a production cost of $217 million.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. So I don't know exactly how much of who is on the hook for what, but that money came from somewhere, and someone's got to be paid back. So that plus P&A costs, you're probably looking at probably somewhere around $700 million before this thing even starts to make a profit.
Wow. Whew. But they, I mean, so the numbers are pretty good, though, overseas, correct?
They're very good overseas, yeah. So, I mean, people are, you know, if you're just focusing on the U.S. numbers, you could be looking at a final gross here somewhere around like $150 million. Or something like that, as a lowball figure. Because, I mean, $45 million on the weekend, this thing's going to drop next week, maybe under 20. That wouldn't even surprise me if it drops that far. All the movies that are opening this weekend,
yeah.
That's very possible. And if that's the truth, this thing's going to come historic low in the U.S., and it's going to be entirely dependent on how it does overseas. And, again, the last couple movies, I mean, we're talking movies that have made over $1 billion worldwide. Hmm. Including the last one, the last Wahlberg film. So, you know, if that one can do it, this one, you can't rule it out until all the numbers come in.
Okay. We have a tie for second place with Cars 3 and Wonder Woman, both with 25.1 million. And Cars 3, how's that? How do those numbers look? It's almost at 100 million.
Yeah, not great, but not catastrophic. I mean, it's, you know, people know that these are kind of the, you know, the black sheep of the Pixar family.
Right, right.
And, you know, clearly, you know, adults are tired of these movies, too. And, you know, so it's going to pull in $100 million by Monday night, which is fine. You know, I think this movie priced, you know, end up making $500 million worldwide. And, you know, that's really all they need.
Yeah.
So they'll be fine.
Yeah. Now, on the other hand, Wonder Woman. I mean, this is just insane.
This is the biggest film of the summer. You know, we talked about it last week. It's not there yet, but it's going to get there. I mean, $318 million right now, $25 million. I think it's the seventh highest fourth weekend of all time.
Wow.
And six of the, like all the other movies on that list, I think, with the exception of Spider-Man, the Sam Raimi's first Spider-Man movie. Mm. I mean, that grossed over $400 million. All the other films on the list grossed over $500 million or more.
Wow.
You're talking like the biggest films of all time having a weekend like this in its fourth week. So this film is going to pass Guardians of the Galaxy eventually, and it's going to be, you know, we'll see how far it goes worldwide. It's probably going to challenge Batman versus Superman. It's gross as whether it gets to a billion. I think that kind of remains to be seen right now. But
I just read, I just read last night that it did pass Batman versus Superman.
Not worldwide, it hasn't.
Oh, okay. All right. Okay.
Yeah, no, I mean, Batman versus Superman did something like 870 million worldwide.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so it's not quite there yet. I think it's like 650, 670, something like that.
Hmm.
So it's got a little ways to go. It could get there. But again, $400 million in the U.S. is coming. It's going to come sooner than later. And that's a remarkable achievement that really nobody saw coming.
Yeah, unbelievable. Unbelievable. Number four, 47 meters down, $7.4 million. $24 million in 2 weeks for a movie that was supposed to go straight to DVD.
Yeah, how is that anything but a victory?
Yeah.
You know, I mean, the numbers might not be sexy. It might not even be Shallow's numbers. But it didn't have a terrible drop this week. You know, for a movie like that, which I thought was going to, you know, drop huge after people saw the kind of subpar quality of it, but they figured, hey, what the heck? There's nothing else going to go. You want to go see Transformers, or you want to go see Mandy Moore trapped in a shark cage?
Yeah. I would choose
That's
the latter.
That's an easy answer.
I would choose the latter, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
A big drop for All Eyes on Me, the Tupac bio, $5.8 million. What did it drop? How much?
77.9%.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, this is the third biggest drop in history for a film that's on over 2,000 screens.
Wow.
That behind Friday the 13th, the remake, was the second highest.
Mm-hmm.
And the highest drop ever was Geely. So that's the company All Eyes on Me keeps right now.
Well, I think it. I think more than anything else, I got to feel that word of mouth did this, because I think, you know, the Tupac fans and the people who were interested in his life story went and hated it, is from what I understand.
Well, I mean, I've heard nothing but bad things about the movie. It was front loaded. That Friday it opened was Tupac's birthday, so. Right. That probably got some people out, but it could be only the second film in history to open to more than 25 million and not reach 50 million.
Mm.
The only other film to do that was the About Last Night remake.
I guess they were thinking that they were hoping for Straight Outta Compton money, right?
Oh yeah, yeah, and clearly they were thrilled with that opening. Last week.
Yeah.
But that opening also suggests that, hey, we're going to make like $75 million out of this thing at least, even if it does drop off. But nearly 78% drop off in the second weekend, and you're going to see it probably drop out of the top 10 possibly by next week with all those movies opening.
Yeah.
So it's going to be gone.
Wow. All right. Number six is The Mummy, $5.8 million, bringing its total up to $68.5 million in America. How's it doing worldwide?
Over $325 million worldwide. Again, this is a movie that it depends on the speculation. You know, there are conflicting reports out there of how much this movie costs, whether it costs $125 million or whether it costs $190
million.
Yeah. You know, and as of right now, the official number released by Universal is $125. So if we go off of that, it's got to make about $400 million, give or take, conservatively, to be in profit.
Mm.
And it could still get there. I mean, it's going to make like 80-some million in the U.S., and then, you know, the cruise power overseas could get it there. But, you know, I don't know where the Dark Universe is going to go next, but I don't think they should. They might want to swap Bride of Frankenstein out for something else.
Yeah. Pirates of the Caribbean, Dead Men Tell No Tales. Its total is $160 million in America, but it's also doing very well overseas.
Yeah, over $500 million overseas alone, almost $700 million worldwide. It's going to be in profit.
Rough Night having a rough night. 4.7 million in 2 weeks, 16 million.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, that's nobody wanted to show up to that.
Yeah. Oh, boy.
Yeah, there's nothing really to say about that other than I think the movie's going to gross less than what I thought it was going to gross opening weekend.
And then before we get Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2, this will be the last week that it's in the top 10, correct?
Yes. Yeah, that should be the last week for that. Captain Underpants might survive one more week.
Mm-hmm.
But then you have the other story is that The Big Sick and The Beguiled both opened in limited release this week. Big Sick's going to expand over the next 3 weeks. But Big Sick had the biggest opening for a five-screen platform since 2013, the second best since La La Land.
Wow.
So that's a really strong number for that. And the Beguiled made more this weekend on four screens than the Bling Ring opened on 650 screens.
Wow. All right, cool. All right, Eric, thanks, man.
Okay.
We will talk to you next week.
Sounds good.
All right, Eric Childress, you can check him out at movies.com to read his box office. And we talk about the movies, review them, and do the box office as well every week. All right, we got to take a break for the news here on 720 WGN.